Hello and welcome to the Compliance Week podcast. I'm Joe Mont, staff writer for Compliance Week. This week we'll be taking a look at some issues that may challenge regulators as they move ahead with President Barack Obama's call to ease sanctions against Cuba. Amid the continuing buzz around the prospect that some American companies will once again be allowed to conduct business in the island nation, we talked to Pedro Frere, chair of the law firm Ackerman's International Practice, and a nationally recognized expert on Cuba-related matters. He served as chair of the Cuba Committee of the Miami Chamber of Commerce and teaches a seminar on Cuba at Columbia University School of Law. As relations normalize, a question that remains unanswered is what to do about the complex legal issue of corporate and individual claims to property that was seized by the Castro regime. Will companies that suffered a loss decades ago be able to receive restitution? Many of those claims have gone through a process called certification, and they're documented in the U.S. Federal Register. Those claims, under U.S. law, will be espoused by the U.S. government and negotiated by the U.S. government on behalf of the claimants. We asked Frere to talk us through this complicated landscape and asked him how difficult it will be for the government to change its existing laws and regulations to meet the trade restoration goals.
On the one hand, there are some things that should be fairly straightforward for the president to carry out his program because he has a broad executive authority under the Constitution and the statutes that govern this area. So in terms of the regulations which interpret the law, the core of the law, the president will be able to carry out a substantial chunk of what he proposed. For example, the authority to open an embassy resides strictly with the president. It's a separate issue on the approval of the funding for the embassy or the approval of the ambassador and the nomination by the Senate. That's a separate matter. But the authority to establish the embassy resides with the president. Likewise, the president has broad executive authority, and so does the Treasury Department and the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which are the agencies that are empowered by statute to do the regulations of the Cuban embargo, to fiddle, if you will, with the rules and regulations that interpret the law. So therefore, for example, the proposal by the president to really give far broader scope to the travel ability of Americans under 12 different licenses to travel is something that the president can bring about. Having said that, the ability of the president to do away with the embargo, the entire Cuban embargo, is simply not there. The core of the embargo is enshrined in legislation. It's a law, and the popular name for that law was the Helms-Burton legislation of 1996. And what the Helms-Burton legislation did is basically took a snapshot of the Cuban embargo, which up to then had been regulations subject to presidential authority, and it basically elevated that to be the law of the land as they were written at that time. It still provided the president sufficient authority to interpret that, but the core of the embargo is there. It's subject to U.S. law, and that law in and of itself contains a series of preconditions which require all these criteria, a series of criteria to be met for the embargo to be lifted. So if the president wants to simply do away with the embargo without having to meet those preconditions, it would require an act of Congress, and that, I think, is going to be tough to get just across the board.
There will, of course, be some challenges and roadblocks, and as we noted, one of those may be the thorny issue of corporate and individual claims to property. We asked him to describe the concern and how these claims are currently handled.
The origin of the U.S. embargo on Cuba is directly connected with these property claims because way back in the early 60s, 62, 63, the Cuban government nationalized a series of U.S. interests in Cuba. I'll give you an example: AT&T, Sears and Roebuck, U.S. Sugar, Texaco and so forth, and basically took over their assets and did not provide fair compensation. That triggered a reaction by the U.S. government, and the precedent under the authority granted to him by the Trading with the Enemy Act, which is something that dated back to 1917, enacted a series of regulations that were the core then of the U.S. embargo on Cuba. So the U.S. embargo starts as a punitive measure, if you will, against the Cuban government, precisely because the Cuban government nationalized the property of American companies and American citizens without providing appropriate compensation. After that, the claims of American citizens were certified by a process governed by the Foreign Claims Act and by the Foreign Claims Commission, which is a semi-judicial body, and it's a branch of the U.S. Department of Justice that is authorized by U.S. law. And what that commission did basically is it sat and adjudicated evidence that was presented on the amount of these losses by the different companies. So, for example, if you were a sugar company from the U.S. and you owned a sugar mill in Cuba, as a hypothetical, and that sugar mill was nationalized, and the sugar mill was worth $10 million. You went to the commission with evidence of your ownership, your stock certificates, your accounting books, your tax returns, your bills of lading, your purchase orders, your contracts, so on and so forth, and you proved to that commission that, in fact, you had had an asset worth the $10 million. If the commission accepted your arguments, found them credible, it basically went through the process of doing something called certification, and it certified that indeed you had lost that particular asset. It then basically memorialized those claims. There's a list of claimants. It's recorded in the Code of Federal Regulations, and that list of claims and those values are now presented to the Department of State so that if the Department of State and establishes a negotiation with the Cuban government for restitution of value for U.S. companies, those are the values that are going to be the basis. Now, it's important to note that these claims and this statute does not provide automatically for payment. There is no funding, if you will, for those payments. The funding has to come out of one of three sources. The first source is the U.S. Congress would basically fund it, authorize it from taxpayer money. That has not happened, and it is not foreseeable that it will happen. The second one would be assets of the Cuban government frozen by the United States and available to pay those compensations. There aren't enough assets of the Cuban government available to the U.S. government to meet those claims. And the third, and this is where the rubber meets the road, the claims would be funded by means of a fund established through a process of negotiation with the Cuban government. And that could take shape of, for example, the Cuban government offering a settlement akin to a bankruptcy proceeding of paying pennies on the dollar or providing tax certificates or providing with the United States for a joint judicial commission that would find other mechanisms to compensate, such as, for example, returning some of those properties to the U.S. claimants and so forth. And that's where it would get a little bit sticky and complicated to find the funding mechanism to pay those claims because at the end of the day, Cuba is bankrupt. The Department of Justice has certified $1.8 billion in claims. That's where it stands right now. There are 8,821 claimants. And these are either U.S. companies or U.S. individuals. And let me make an aside here that's important to note. There was a Cuba claims program. There's been two tranches to that program. It got reopened a few years ago. Some claimants came forth. Very few claims were adjudicated and approved, and then the program was closed. In order for a person to qualify or an entity to qualify under that program of certification, the entity or the individual has to have been a U.S. citizen at the time that the property was confiscated. So, for example, the very broad class of Cuban Americans, and I would fit within that class, would not be under the shelter of that law, if you will. We are sort of floating out in the Florida Straits in terms of where our rights would be in order to claim against the Cuban government.
How might these claims be handled now and in the future?
We're now beginning to navigate some uncharted waters. And I say that with pause because similar waters, to continue the metaphor, have been navigated. And I'll give you an example. The United States and Iran, of all countries, have a joint claims commission that was established, enshrined under this law, to adjudicate the claims arising out of the Iranian Revolution. That is still going on after 34 years. No resolution has been reached. So one possible mechanism is to have that sort of a joint claims commission between Cuba and the U.S. that adjudicates this. This is complicated by the fact that Cuba has already staked its territory by having countervailing legislation against the United States alleging substantial losses purportedly caused by the U.S. embargo. So whatever mechanism is reached, whatever negotiation is established by the U.S. Department of State, you can be sure that there will be countervailing claims by the Cuban government, which will further complicate the resolution.
We also asked him to discuss the non-certified claims, especially those that aren't currently protected or governed by U.S. law. What might be seen in terms of those negotiations, and how might they differ?
Let's not forget the certified claims are sheltered, if you will. They're protected. They're espoused. The concept is called espousal by the United States government. So the full weight and power, if you will, of the United States government goes behind those claims. And when the Cuban diplomats sit at the table, they're going to sit across U.S. diplomats who will be basically representing the U.S. claimant. So there's a lot of heft and power behind the certified claims. Not so for the claims of Cuban Americans. And here I'm going to put myself as an example. My family had a number of assets in Cuba, rental properties, personal property, residential property, my father's business, and so forth. All of that was confiscated by the Cuban government without confiscation. We are now all U.S. citizens. My parents have passed away and left six heirs behind. We are not the holders of any certified claims, nor could we qualify for any certified claims. So basically, we have no remedy in U.S. courts because the actions of the Cuban government were the actions of a sovereign, and they would not be subject to litigation in the U.S. court. So a potential remedy would be for us to go to a Cuban court, and I can only conjecture on how successful we would be in a Cuban court. So a potential remedy here would be that a Cuban government would see the wisdom, and I do believe, I don't say this facetiously, I think it would be indeed very wise for a future Cuban government to find a mechanism, such as, for example, establishing a court of claims, to provide some measure of compensation to Cuban Americans. And that compensation could be very creative. It could take the form of tax credits to incentivize Cuban Americans to go back and invest in Cuba and provide basically tax holidays for their profits in Cuba. Or it could take the form of a multi-layered, multifaceted program that would, for example, incentivize Cuban Americans who are very good at, say, for example, running the sugar industry of going back and taking over the same properties that they used to own on the condition that they would fund them, capitalize them, modernize them, and run them. That would be to the benefit of Cuba, would be to the benefit of the Cuban government, and it would be ultimately to the benefit of the Cuban claimant. So you could foresee a mixed model put forth by a reform or transitional Cuban government that wants to basically smoke the peace pipe, if you will, with Cuban Americans, and you could see Cuban Americans joining in that process because, number one, they will derive some sort of compensation, and number two, very importantly, they would help in the future development of the island.
We were talking to Pedro Frere, chair of the law firm Ackerman's international practice and an internationally recognized expert on Cuba. He's been talking to us about some complications that might arise as the U.S. eases trade sanctions against that country. I'm Joe Mott, staff writer for Compliance Week. Thank you for listening and hope you join us again next time.